Last week, we sort of finished Jeremiah. We got all the way through chapter 51. 52 is just a bullet point recap of the history, and I'm not going to go through that tonight, other than to let you know that there are some differences between the Jeremiah account and 2 Kings. The differences include dates when Nebuchadnezzar did his various invasions, and discrepancies in the number of people taken. The commentary that I have said, okay, there's two perspectives on this. We don't know which one's right. I don't either. I'm not going to go through it, but if you want to compare the end of 2 Kings side by side with the end of Jeremiah, you will notice that there are some differences. With that, we're going to go into Lamentations. Lamentations is not signed, but as near as I can tell, pretty much everybody thinks it's Jeremiah that wrote it. It's a series of five poems, lamentations, if you will, about the destruction of Jerusalem. And obviously it happens after the country is destroyed. It's very poetic. As we go through it, I suspect most of you know the cross references. I will point them out just in case you don't and are too embarrassed to ask. So, Lamentations. How lonely sits the city that was full of people? How like a widow has she become? She who was great among the nations, she who was a princess among the provinces, has become a slave. You all, of course, know your Bible history. Jerusalem was a Jebusite city. It's the place where Melchizedek came from to greet Abram. And it was conquered by David. And when David became the king, he started off as king over Judah and Hebron, and then became king over all of Israel, northern and southern, and moved his capital to Jerusalem after having taken it from the Jebusites. David and Solomon ruled everything from Egypt all the way up to the Euphrates River. Jerusalem was a major city, major center of civilization, major power in the region. For example, if you read Chronicles, Queen of Sheba travels to Jerusalem just to talk to Solomon. And Solomon had some problems, but he was an excellent bureaucrat. And so he set up supply cities and fortifications and labor squads and all that kind of stuff, and he built a great deal. So Jerusalem was a big deal. After Solomon's death, of course, you know the country split into north and south, and Jerusalem remained the capital of the south, and the north had various places, but they changed dates and times and set up golden calves at Bethel and Dan, and so they went into exile before Judah did. Of course, when Judah goes into exile, that's when Jerusalem is destroyed. So the beginning is, how lonely sits the city that was full of people, and how like a widow has she become, she who was great among the nations. And she was a major power in the time of David and Solomon. And after that, it just sort of steadily went downhill until finally the place gets sanded off by Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 2. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks. Among all her lovers, she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt treacherously with her. They have become her enemies. God regards the treaties that Jerusalem made with surrounding nations for purposes of aggrandizing her power or keeping herself safe as taking on lovers, because one of the things that typically happened, it certainly happened with Solomon, when Solomon would make diplomatic marriages. One of his first diplomatic marriages was he married Pharaoh's daughter, and he made a number of diplomatic marriages and a whole bunch of non-diplomatic marriages. But one of the things that happened as these wives came into his harem is they all wanted a place to worship the gods of their homeland. And of course, that led him to be building high places and idols throughout the land. And that's the reason that the kingdom was split after his death. God says, I'm going to take the kingdom away from the house of David. For David's sake, I will leave you two tribes, but the other 10 tribes are going to tear away from you. And that's, of course, the northern kingdom. It doesn't happen during Solomon's lifetime, but it happens immediately after his son ascends the throne. You all know the story there. The people in the north came to him after Solomon's death and said, you need to cut our taxes. Your dad taxed us very heavily to build all the supply cities and the fortifications and all that kind of stuff. Cut our taxes and we'll stay with you. And of course he said no, after consulting with the young men. And that's when they left. Now God said they were going to leave, but this kid is inexperienced and stupid on steroids. Verse 3. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all overtaken her in the midst of her distress. Obviously, when God scatters them, a great many of them go to Babylon, but not all. Some of them wind up in Egypt. Some of them, I'm sure, wind up scattered across the Fertile Crescent. It's been a while since we did biblical geography. But if you look at the world from a biblical perspective, you've got the Mediterranean Sea on the east of Israel, and you've got the Arabian Desert on the west. Before the Phoenicians and deep water sailing or blue water sailing, the only way to go from north to south would be to hop along the coast and stay in sight of the coast. Similarly, moving an army across the Arabian Desert was not an easy thing. So in order to have commerce or conquest between northern Africa and southern Eurasia and so forth, you had to go through Israel. The way I describe it is, anybody ever been bird hunting, quail hunting? I used to go quail hunting all the time when I was in Texas, loved it. When you go quail hunting, you come out and you got burrs all over your trousers. Well, you're annoyed at having burrs all over you, but what you're doing is you're transplanting burrs. So every time an army or whatever swept through Israel, they wound up picking up Israelites and scattering them north and south, so you wound up with synagogues from the bottom of the Nile all the way to Spain and all the way over to India. So what God was doing by putting them there was spreading his word throughout the world, because as they went, they would set up synagogues and they would have the Torah and so forth, and so the word spread. But there was always either Judah or Israel until after Nebuchadnezzar finally clobbered them. So even though they had spread the word throughout the entire region there, there was home. Now there's not home anymore. 4. The road to Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan, her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. Zion obviously is another name for Jerusalem, and you all know your Torah that everybody was to come up for the feasts 3 times a year. And so what he's saying here is that's all stopped now. When the northern kingdom split off from the southern kingdom, Jeroboam didn't want to have his people trucking to Jerusalem 3 times a year, because he was afraid if that happened that they would eventually recoalesce into one country and he would be killed. So in addition to building golden calves at Bethel and Dan, what he did is he shifted the feast days by a month. So he said, not only don't you have to go down to Jerusalem, but these are the new feast days, and you don't have to mess with those that God ordained. So the roads to Zion mourn because there's nobody coming up for the feasts anymore. Verse 5, her foes have become the head, her enemies prosper, because the Lord has afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone away, captives before the foe. Verse 6, from the daughter of Zion all her majesty has departed. Her princes have become like deer that find no pasture. They fled without strength before the pursuer. And the metaphor there is a starving animal of prey who is fleeing before its pursuers, but because it is also starving, it isn't going very far. That's as opposed to the metaphor that's used in Genesis and Deuteronomy, where you have, in Genesis, Jacob blesses his sons, and in Deuteronomy, Moses blesses the tribe. And in both cases, you have Judah as a lion, and Ephraim or Joseph is like a wild ox. Both are animals of great strength and power, and now they have become like deer who don't have any pasture. So instead of being these powerful animals, they have become wimpy and afraid. Verse 7, Jerusalem remembers in the days of her affliction and wandering all the precious things that were hers from days of old. When her people fell into the hand of the foe, and there was none to help her, her foes gloated over her. They mocked at her downfall. Remembering the days of particularly David and Solomon, but even after that, Israel continued to be a major trading nation because of her geographic location. The wealth of Solomon and David had to do with the trade that went north and south through Israel, and that didn't go away. So they were very prosperous and well off. And the idea here is they treated their trading partners in God's eyes as lovers, had respect for their gods, intermarried with them and so forth, all of which were things God said don't do. So the idea is her lovers used to be her trading partners and her military allies, but once her power is broken, they all turned on her simultaneously. And of course, when we went through Jeremiah, you all remember that God had a curse for each of the nations around Israel because of the way that they had treated Israel when God chastened them. So this mirrors Jeremiah, where all of her lovers have turned on her and are looting her instead of trading with her. Verse 8, Jerusalem sinned grievously. Therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. The image there is Nida, which is a woman's monthly cycle. So she is a woman in her impurity, and everybody has seen her delicate parts, and nobody wants her. So she is an unclean woman who nobody wants. Verse 10. The enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. Two things going on there. Thing one is, of course, Nebuchadnezzar did enter the temple and looted the place twice. And then those whom you forbade to enter your congregation, again, as you remember your Torah, there are lists of people that Israelites were not to intermarry with. You know, a Moabite can't come into the congregation up until the 10th generation, you know, those kinds of things. So the temple has been defiled, the sanctuary, and you have got people coming into the congregation that God has said shall not. So both of those things are going on. Let's do 8 and 9 in a swoop. Jerusalem sinned grievously, therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. Her uncleanness is in her skirts. She took no thought of her future. Therefore her fall is terrible. She has no comforter. O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. As I said earlier, the whole image there is of a prostitute that nobody's interested in anymore. And this idea of her uncleanliness is in her skirts, and she took no thought of her future. One of the things that young people do, both men and women, but this is talking in a feminine sense, is until they get some sense, they don't plan for the future. So the metaphor here is of a beautiful prostitute who is trading on her beauty without regard to the fact that her physical beauty is going to fade quickly, and she better come up with some other way to earn a living. So this idea of prostitute who is beyond her prime and nobody's interested in it anymore. Then verse 10, the enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she has seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. Entering the sanctuary was what Nebuchadnezzar did when he first looted the place and then destroyed it. And then, of course, you have the surrounding nations are entering the congregation, which is to say intermarrying, which was forbidden in the Torah. Verse 11, all her people groan as they search for bread. They trade their treasures for food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, and see, for I am despised. Part of the deal with Nebuchadnezzar destroying the place was he cut off access to food and so forth, and there was mass starvation inside the city. And she is so desperate that she is overpaying for food, which is to say she's trading her treasures for food, as opposed to simply buying them and or raising them in normal commerce. Verse 12, is it nothing to you, all who pass by, look and see, if there is any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. One of the things that's happened is all of her lovers have turned against her, which are the nations around, and they have no pity. They look upon her and they have no pity whatsoever. Verse 13, from on high he sent fire into my bones. He made it descend. He spread a net for my feet. He turned me back. He has left me stunned, faint all the day long. And what this is saying is that her defeat was supernatural. It was done by the Babylonians, but the reason that the Babylonians were able to do that is because of Israel's sin and the fact that God turned away from them. In fact, Moses predicts in Deuteronomy, what they say is that all this has come upon them because the Lord has forsaken them. And of course, the reason that the Lord forsakes them is because they have forsaken him first. What Moses says, or actually God says through Moses, is you're going to abandon the covenant. Then God is going to turn his back on you. Then bad things are going to happen to you. Then you're going to say, all of this bad stuff has happened to us because God has turned his back on us. And you are going to blame God for your problems when the genesis of your problem was the fact that you turned from God in the first place. So what we have here in verse 13, from on high he sent fire into my bones and made it descend. He spread a net for my feet. He turned me back. He left me stunned, faint all the day long. In other words, God is the reason for all of this. And Jeremiah is saying that, as opposed to what Moses predicts. So Jeremiah here in Lamentation is saying, this is all our fault. We are the ones who did it. And because we did it, God has invoked the downside of the covenant, and it's our own fault. So verse 14, my transgressions were bound into a yoke. By his hand they were fastened together. They were set upon my neck. He caused my strength to fail. The Lord gave me into the hands of those whom I cannot withstand. And obviously, Israel's transgressions have been bound into a yoke by God and put upon their neck. And when the consequences of her behavior finally land on her, she can't withstand it. Verse 15. The Lord rejected all my mighty men in my midst. He summoned an assembly against me to crush my young men. The Lord has trodden as in a winepress the virgin daughter of Judah. This is all things that God has done by invoking the downside of the covenant. Covenant obviously has two sides. If you obey and do what I want you to do, everything will be wonderful and you'll be prosperous, and the nations will look at you and say, wow, what a wise people who has a God like this, and you're going to be blessed amazingly. However, if you turn and follow other gods, just as good as the good is, it will be that bad on the downside. The amount of swing, if you will be equal in both directions. So what God is doing is invoking the downside of the covenant. And Jeremiah recognizes that. Verse 16, for these things I weep, my eyes flow with tears, for a comforter is far from me, one to revive my spirit. My children are desolate, for the enemy has prevailed. At this point, all of this is fresh, and he doesn't see any hope at this point. Now, we'll get to hope later, but right now he's lamenting his current situation, and things are not looking hopeful to him at all. Verse 17, Zion stretches out her hands, but there is none to comfort her. The Lord has commanded against Jacob that his neighbors should be his foes. Jerusalem has become a filthy thing among them. When we went through Jeremiah, we had all the prophecies of the surrounding nations who, when Judah fell under Babylon, turned around and piled on. And by the way, remember I said earlier that Israel was a major power in the region and continued to be prosperous and so forth, even after the division between the two kingdoms. One of the things that generates is envy. David, as he pacified the whole region around, lots of these small nations around Israel were put under tribute, and they were required to pay or provide labor or whatever. So when Solomon died, that started to come apart. Those nations that were around her started to split off. But in all cases, there was this normal human envy of Israel because she was in a prime location, you know, the trade route down the coast and so forth. She was wealthy. She had in the past been the top dog in the neighborhood. So there was built up resentment. And so when she's taken out by Nebuchadnezzar, all of that resentment comes to the top, and they gleefully participate in her destruction. Verse 18, the Lord is in the right, for I have rebelled against his word. But hear, all you peoples, and see my suffering. My young women and my young men have gone into captivity. God is right, but have pity on me. Verse 19, I called to my lovers, but they deceived me. My priests and elders perished in the city while they sought food to revive their strength. The lovers she is talking about here are the surrounding nations. One of the things that Judah did as Nebuchadnezzar was spinning up to come down is she tried to make military alliances to save herself. And God referred to the nations with whom she tried to make alliances as her lovers. And in verse 19, she calls to her lovers in her distress, and they aren't there anymore, which again takes you back to the metaphor of when she was young and pretty, which is to say powerful and prosperous. She had lots of lovers, but she didn't pay attention to the future. And now she's no longer powerful and lovely, so all of the lovers that she bought, she doesn't have anymore. And she's got nothing to buy them with. 20. Look, O Lord, for I am in distress. My stomach churns. My heart is wrung within me, because I have been very rebellious. In the streets, the sword bereaves. In the house, it is like death. So you have famine, pestilence, and the sword. Everybody is afflicted. 21. They heard my groaning, yet there is no one to comfort me. All my enemies have heard of my trouble. They are glad that you have done it. You have brought the day you announced. Now let them be as I am. That was what I was saying earlier. The envy of the nations around. All my enemies are glad that you have done it, that God has finally stepped in and exercised the downside of the covenant. And you have brought the day you have announced. Now let them be as I am, which is to say, I am now destroyed. Let them be destroyed also. Remembering the various prophecies against surrounding nations in Jeremiah, that's what we're talking about. Verse 22, let all their evil doing come before you and deal with them as you have dealt with me, because of all my transgressions, for my groans are many and my heart is faint. Obviously, what's happened to me is just, but they have piled on, so take vengeance on them too. The commentary that comes with my Bible program has got an interesting comment on chapter 2. Chuck Swindoll, obviously a Bible teacher and a preacher that most people have heard of, has appropriately titled this chapter, Words from the Woodshed, because Judah has been taken to the woodshed, and I'm going to talk about that. So chapter 2, how the Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. The idea, of course, is they have the temple, or had, and that metaphorically was God's footstool on the earth. And you all remember in Jeremiah that the inhabitants of Judah could not believe that God was going to let his temple be defiled and destroyed. And since they had the temple in the midst of the city, that was going to be their security. Of course, God, through Jeremiah, says, no, you're like a band of robbers, and you're treating my temple like it was a hideout. So you go hit the bank, and then you run to your hideout while the posse is out after you. And once the posse cools down, you go back out again. My temple is not going to be a hideout for a bunch of robbers. So here, he's mourning the fact that he didn't remember his footstool. And, of course, in Jeremiah, he said he wouldn't. Verse 2, the Lord has swallowed up without mercy all the inhabitants of Jacob. In his wrath, he has broken down the strongholds of the daughter of Judah. He has brought down to the ground in dishonor the kingdom and its rulers. Verse 3, he has cut down in fierce anger all the might of Israel. He has withdrawn from them his right hand in the face of the enemy. He has burned like a flaming fire in Jacob, consuming all around. Obviously, the metaphor here is fairly consistently when Israel is behaving and they go out against their enemies, God is on their side and they wind up getting tremendous victories. And so the idea that he's withdrawn his right hand indicates that we no longer have that advantage strategically. Verse 4, he has bent his bow like an enemy, with his right hand set like a foe. He has killed all who were delightful in our eyes. In the tent of the daughter of Zion, he has poured out his fury like fire. The actual perpetrators of that are the Babylonians, but lamentation recognizes that it's God who's doing it. Verse 5. The Lord has become like an enemy. He has swallowed up Israel. He has swallowed up all its palaces. He has laid in ruin its stronghold. He has multiplied in the daughter of Judah mourning and lamentation. And of course, you all know that when Nebuchadnezzar comes through the second time, he levels the place. The first time he came through, he left a government intact because he wanted Israel to be a vassal state and he wanted it to be a going concern so that he could tribute. And when they rebelled, he came and cleaned them out. Verse 6. He has laid waste his booth like a garden, laid in ruins his meeting place. The Lord has made Zion forget festival and Sabbath, and in his fierce indignation has spurned king and priest. So the idea is God is not happy with the religious establishment. And we saw that back in Jeremiah 5, where it said, the prophets prophesy falsely in my name, the priests ratify it, and my people love it so. You had false prophecies that were agreed to by the religious establishment, and everybody liked it because didn't have to do all that difficult Torah stuff. So the idea of king and priest both being taken out is an indicator of total government destruction. Both the king and the religious authority have been taken out. Verse 7. The Lord has scorned his altar, disowned his sanctuary. He has delivered into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces. They raised a clamor in the house of the Lord, as in the day of the festival. They raised a clamor. They are the Babylonian troops. So when the Babylonians went into the house of the Lord, they were tearing the place down, and there were so many of them and were so noisy, it sounded like a feast. You know, one of the feast days when Jerusalem was full of people. Verse 8, the Lord determined to lay in ruins the wall of the daughter of Zion. He stretched out the measuring line. He did not restrain his hand from destroying. He caused rampart and wall to lament. They languished together. The idea of stretching out a measuring line, we see that several places in Scripture. And the idea is, I am measuring their iniquity. So you have an angelic being with a measuring line or a measuring rod, and he measures the place. And the idea is he is calculating the degree of their iniquity. And the idea with precise measurement is, oh, and by the way, the recompense for that will be every bit as precise as the sin that you did. So the idea of measurement is measure for measure. Verse 9, her gates have sunk into the ground. He has ruined and broken her bars. Her king and princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. Total destruction of the entire government system. The princes are among the nations, which is to say they've been taken into exile. And the law is no more, which is to say nobody is following Torah in the land anymore. And of course, part of the problem is they weren't following it before. And then prophecy has also disappeared, and no vision from the Lord. I'm in Isaiah 29, verse 9. Astonish yourselves and be astonished. Blind yourselves and be blind. Be drunk, but not with wine. Stagger, but not with strong drink. For the Lord has poured out upon you a spirit of deep sleep. He has closed your eyes, the prophets, and covered your head, the seers. And a vision of all this has become to you like the words of a book that is sealed. When men give it to one who can read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot, for it's sealed. And when they give the book to one who cannot read, saying, read this, he says, I cannot read. And by the way, at the end of Isaiah 29, he reverses that process. But the idea here is when God has determined to take action because of Israel's sins, first off, he stops the prophets, quits talking to them. Because remember, a prophet is sent to you when there is still hope that you might turn around. So he stops the prophets, And then he has covered the heads, which is the seers, the wise men. So you don't have prophecy, which is fresh word from God, and you don't have wise men. And then the final thing he does is he closes the book. So let's go back now to Lamentation. Verse 9, her gates have sunk into the ground. He has ruined and broken her bars. Her king and princes are among the nations. The law is no more, and her prophets find no vision from the Lord. So the book is closed, the prophets don't get any word, and her leadership, the kings and princes who are supposed to be her wise men, have been scattered into exile. It's slightly different poetic language, but it's basically what Isaiah describes in chapter 29, verse 10. The elders of the daughter of Zion sit on the ground in silence. They have thrown dust on their heads and put on sackcloth. The young women of Jerusalem have bowed their heads to the ground. Obviously, symbols of mourning, sitting on the ground, dust on your head, sackcloth, and so forth. Verse 11, my eyes are spent with weeping, my stomach churns, my bile is poured out on the ground because of the destruction of the daughter of my people, because infants and babies faint in the streets of the cities. He's describing the siege when there's nothing to eat and you have pestilence and so forth. 12, they cry to their mothers, where's bread and wine, as they faint like a wounded man in the streets of the city, as their life is poured out on their mother's bosom. You got a mixed metaphor here. I read that, it was like, wait a minute, little children asking for wine. It's obviously a mixed metaphor. 13, what can I say for you? To what compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What can I liken to you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is vast as the sea. Who can heal you? The idea is, things are so bad that I can't think of any words of comfort. 14. Your prophets have seen for you false and deceptive visions. They have not exposed your iniquity to restore your fortunes, but have seen for you oracles that are false and misleading. And that's what I was saying earlier from Jeremiah chapter 5. You've got prophets who are giving false and deceptive visions, and they're saying the stuff that you're doing is okay. God approves. And God doesn't approve. And until you get that straight, your fortunes will not be restored. You've got to give up these cheerful prophecies that the false prophets are feeding you. Verse 15. All who pass along the way clap their hands at you. They hiss and wag their heads at the daughter of Jerusalem. Is this the city that was called the perfection of beauty, the joy of all the earth? Jerusalem used to be a big deal and continued to be a big deal even after the glory of Solomon passed. So people going by saying, wow, look what's happened to this place. It used to be the perfection of beauty and the joy of all the earth. 16, all your enemies rail against you. They hiss, they gnash their teeth, they cry, we have swallowed her. Ah, this is the day we longed for. Now we have it, we see it. There was a great deal of envy among the surrounding nations while Israel was powerful. And now that she's not powerful anymore, they are gloating over her. Ah, this is the day we have longed for. We wanted to have her taken down a notch for a long time. 17, the Lord has done what he purposed. He has carried out his word, which he commanded long ago. He has thrown down without pity. He has made the enemy rejoice over you and exalted the might of your foes. Their heart cried to the Lord, O wall of the daughter of Zion, let tears stream down like a torrent, day and night. Give yourself no rest, your eyes no respite. And what he's obviously saying is, we have a covenant, and the covenant's got two sides. So the covenant of old is being executed right now. 19, arise, cry in the night, at the beginning of the night watches. Pour out your heart like water. before the presence of the Lord. Lift your hands to him for the lives of your children who faint for hunger at the head of every street. Obviously, pray, but at the moment it isn't going to do much good. Verse 20. Look, O Lord, and see, with whom have you dealt thus? Should women eat the fruit of their womb, the children of their tender care? Should priest and prophet be killed in the sanctuary of the Lord? We've all read lots of prophecy, and you recognize that this is one of the things that happens in a biblical era siege. 21. In the dust of the streets lie the young and the old. My young women and my young men have fallen by the sword. You have killed them in the day of your anger, slaughtering without pity. You summoned as if to a festival day my terrors on every side. And on the day of the anger of the Lord, no one escaped or survived. Those whom I held and raised, my enemy destroyed. Those whom I held and raised are children. So, total destruction, obviously. And we also have the historical account of the same thing. But this is a poetic lamentation about it. So, next time, we'll start coming up the other side. Because so far, it has been unrelieved sorrow, terror, and destruction. And next time, we'll start coming up the far side with hope, which God always leaves us with.